From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in for Chris Boyd. There is a tendency of most in Western society to see history as the story of human beings constantly progressing through the ages, moving forward in a linear path. We certainly see that with science and new discoveries based on previous research and advances. What about human freedom? Is our idea of one person, one vote in a democracy always an improvement over what it replaces? Priya Sethia is the Raymond A. Spruance Professor of International History at Stanford. She specializes in modern British history and history of the British Empire. In an article for Foreign Policy magazine entitled "Democracy Isn't Just About Voting, Pre-Colonial Kingdoms Challenge Our Beliefs About People, Power, and Monarchies," she makes the argument expanding the pool of voters may not be enough. She joins us this hour. Welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
So let's start off. You're not advocating a return to monarchy.
No, not at all. I'm just advocating that we learn more first about, you know, what older monarchies were like and sort of get over our kind of knee-jerk equation of monarchy with despotism and the assumption that goes with that, that representative liberal democracy that we have in the U.S. is sort of the best and the only way to be a democratic polity.
Yeah, I want to go about this a bit differently, if we can. I want to begin by talking about the importance of history in how ethics and through them concepts of what democracy is are passed down, not just from one generation to the next, but also from other countries. History is key. An understanding of history is key, right?
Yeah, and there's certain ways, like you started out talking about this assumption that history should be a story of progress. I mean, that's a very particular understanding of how history works. That's actually very, you know, you can date it to the 18th century and the transatlantic enlightenment, and it's not the necessary truth, right? It's a theory of history that a lot of historians and other philosophers have actually questioned, because the record of history suggests that it actually is not a story of progress, right? So you have to kind of figure out what assumptions you're about history you're bringing to your reflections on democracy or monarchy and so on.
You know, we understand the influence of religion and the teaching of ethics, but history has a lot to do with where we are today. And it really, as you say, has a lot to do with our ideas about democracy here and democracy elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, we've had this assumption in the modern period of history, by which I mean sort of the 18th through century to our present, that the main narrative of global history has been to nudge people away from their traditional forms of rule, which usually means monarchy, some form of monarchy, towards a kind of democracy that looks like American-style democracy. Which is strange, because American-style democracy started in the 18th century itself. You know, it's not, and it's, you know, it's included more and more people, but it was produced by, you know, a kind of historical turn in the 18th century, where they're actually looking back to classical civilization, right, like the ancient Greeks, and trying to revive a certain kind of history in a new form. To be modern. So, I mean, there are ways in which history and historical thinking are sort of looping around each other, and it's very difficult to kind of disentangle the narrative.
You've written, for example, that the British view of pre-colonial India is that before the British arrived, the rulers there were little more than Oriental despots, and they would be better off if they just brought these Western liberal ideas to save everyone. That was the mindset at the time.
Yes, that was how the British justified their interventions and intrusions in South Asia, where present day India is. And that was a region that had a number of emerging monarchies, you know, as the pushing back against them. There was a big empire there too, the Mughal Empire, which is itself a monarchical formation. But then there were other kind of kingdoms emerging as well in the same region. So it was a very dynamic time politically when the British also show up in the region. And the way they sort of kind of stereotype the style of rule in the subcontinent was that this was just Oriental despotism and that people in India need these ideas. They need to import the British version of, you know, what modern rule is like, or what the British have to offer in order to progress in history.
You know, and actually, if you take a look at this, as you point out in the article, in pre-colonial India, there were some strong reciprocal relations between some rulers and those they ruled, as, for example, a means of stemming famine, for example. And so there were these relationships that did seem to work.
Yeah, I mean, if we think of if we sort of define a democratic polity as a polity in which the people have a voice and the people have political power, you can see that existing in some monarchies in South Asia and elsewhere in the world, you know, before the onslaught of British or French or, you know, whatever European kind of colonialism, where you have polities in which rulers cannot just, you know, have their way. They depend on the assent of the people who are their subjects. And so there has to be kind of a meeting point between what rulers want and what the ruled want. So, for instance, as you said, in dealing with the possibility of famine, rulers in some of these pre-colonial monarchies would have grain stores, maintained in case there's some kind of famine. And this looks like a kind of paternalistic thing, but it's not just sheer charity that's driving this. This is the fact they understand that if they don't do things like this, then in a time of desperate food shortage, the people that they rule are going to take forcible action, right? They're going to seize grain that's available, or they'll leave the polity and withdraw their labor and go somewhere else. So they basically will stop consenting in the regime. And then what will be the source of revenue for that, the monarch, right, whose kingdom depends on the labor of the ruled. And so there was this like dynamic of reciprocity between rulers and ruled. And of course, that is a monarchical setup, but that doesn't mean that there's no democratic power at work in that polity.
So this is working in some places and working effectively, and it's a means of security with regard to those who are in power. But when the British arrive, those places where there is this reciprocal order that's going on, when the British arrive, they essentially destroy that, don't they?
Yeah, the British come with certain ideas about political economy, liberal political economy, that according to which, you know, some of these precautions that Indian rulers have been taking, like maintaining stores of grain and giving out food, you know, as charity in a time of dearth, that was a violation of British principles of liberal political economy. So when the British come in and take over some of these areas, they don't carry on those kinds of practices. So in a time of famine, their thinking would be, wow, this is really painful to watch, but we have to let the market correct itself. And if we interfere by giving handouts to people, we'll not be allowing the market to work the way it should for the sake of future progress. Like, they're always justifying, you know, tough action now with the idea that it will be vindicated by progress in the future. And so you see a real change in how things like famine are dealt with, and you see severe famines happening in the era of British rule that actually have ceased since India and Pakistan became independent in 1947.
Yeah, I mean, you get the impression that where there was a reciprocal relationship, now the British have created what they hope to avoid. Is that correct? What they hope to avoid, I think. But what I'm saying is the British have seemed to have been able to put in place a situation, a regime that they claimed they were going to try to get rid of, but now it's there because they are there.
Right. They become the despotic rulers. And they know that. They say that. Like in the essay that appeared in Foreign Policy, I quote John Stuart Mill, who's the famous philosopher of liberty. And he worked for the East India Company that ruled British India until 1858. And he said in an 1859 essay on liberty that the despotism that we're engaging in India is completely legitimate because these are, you know, it's a very racialized view. He's saying we're dealing with barbarians, right? And so, and the purpose of despotism for now, it's again, this like temporary, you know, something that needs to be justified for now, is that in the future, you know, this is going to result in them, in these barbarians being improved and, you know, they'll have progress. And so they know what they're doing is despotism, but they justify it by saying it's a better kind of despotism than you know, what they imagine to have been Oriental Indian pre-colonial despotism in the same region.
Yeah, a lot of what we believe about democracy and what they believed at the time. This is an era, and you've mentioned this a little bit. This is an era when the idea is that the great men of society should be the ones who really direct things. And we should use their ideas. And even if their ideas somehow go off, they should still be followed because they're great men.
Right. So what's so interesting is that you have this great man view of history coming out in the 18th and 19th and even 20th centuries, at the same in the very countries like the US and Britain, where you know, that we see as the homes of mass democracy emerging in the 19th century. So what's the story? Do they say great men make history, or should the people make history? And in a weird way, and this is the problem with kind of the equation that came about in the 19th century of democracy with mass voting, like democracy just means the capacity to vote, that, you know, what it was actually about, people voting in a very, so having a very limited idea of how people collectively participate in politics. It's only through voting. It should not be through rioting. It should not be through crowd action. You know, it should be very kind of disciplined and one day out of 365 days in the year, you know. And meanwhile, let the great men take care of everything else. So in a weird way, what we take as, you know, the very definition of modern democracy was all about, you know, actually limiting very much, restricting how the people act politically. Whereas if you look at some of these pre-colonial Indian monarchies, or even pre-18th century, or actually early 18th century British monarchy, you know, you see a world in which crowds of people, collective action is much more powerful, because when people didn't have the vote, they had to act in everyday ways collectively to make sure that their voices were heard and that they had that reciprocal relationship with the state and with the monarch.
You know, the difficulty with this idea of great men is that their viewpoints aren't tested and aren't questioned as much as everybody else's, simply because of who they are. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, in some ways, like, this is an era in which they're saying monarchy is backward, like an absolutist kind of monarchy is backward. So we don't want that kind of great man. But you do want, it's an era in which they say a great man like John Stuart Mill is someone who, you know, can have a special role in the making of history and the making of our ideas about history, or someone like, you know, Winston Churchill, a great prime minister who is, you know, democratically elected, but entrusted with this capacity to sort of understand things and take care of the making of history, you know, on his own. And he's also a historian, right? So yeah, those things become strangely compatible in Anglo-American thought, you know, from the 18th century on.
I want to get back to that idea about a great, great men, and the fact that they really are the ones who are pushing this idea of how we should view democracy and that sort of thing. What's also going on is this is during the period of the Industrial Revolution. So we're seeing all of these massive changes in society. And does that not make people think that, well, maybe we're on the right track with all this?
Yeah. So what happens is that there's the Industrial Revolution creates social revolution in the sense that the way people live, the kinds of livelihoods they had, the places that they lived in are very quickly transformed. And ordinary people in Britain, let's take that as our setting, move to cities, they move off the land, they lose access to lands that were held and used commonly before the Industrial Revolution. And there are new kinds of jobs, they're de-skilled, and that means that they have less power vis-a-vis their employers. So that's their situation, and they want to address that. They don't have the right to vote, right, yet. And so, but the messaging that they're getting and the political ideas that are in the air, and this is also the age of, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and so on, is that the right to vote is going to solve our problems, right? Like, if we can have access to Parliament and have our voice heard there and have our own representatives, then we can address all the social problems that we're having, all the dispossession that we're experiencing, all the trauma that we're experiencing. And so the focus of political movements by those who don't have the vote in the 19th century is to get the vote. And so you have this kind of ironic outcome where, they succeed eventually. There are moments of, expanding where the franchise is expanded in Britain in 1832, in 1867, in 1884, and then again after World War I and again after World War II. So it's this process of more and more people getting the vote, and it looks like, well, there's an increasingly democratic polity. But in fact, what you actually see happening is that people get the vote, but they have less and less room for political expression. You can vote, but the crowd politics that they relied on to get the vote, those start to go away, right? And the spaces in which you can express your political voice sort of shrink, and the alliances between classes and so on break down. And so you have more and more people voting, but less and less room for political expression and fewer forms of political expression, where things used to be on the street and oral and expressed in song or expressed with body language. And in pamphlets and, radical pamphlets with really melodramatic narratives and so on. And this is work from my colleague at Berkeley, James Vernon. He's written about this. Now you just have people going in a very disciplined fashion, thinking of themselves as dutiful citizens and dropping their ballot in the box, right? That's the kind of only acceptable form of political action increasingly as you get through the modern period. And that's what's considered appropriate political action. And so then when people do erupt as crowds or in massive protests that sometimes become unruly and so on, it's sort of like an indiscipline that, it creates problems. We still have like a problem accepting that as sort of the way to be in a modern Western liberal democracy, whether UK or US.
Yeah, you've written that women in particular seem to be affected by what's going on in terms of these changes that we're talking about.
Right. So when no ordinary people had the vote in Britain, for instance, men and women were in the same boat, right? So they would all be participating very actively in crowd politics, and in fact, in riots, that would occur. When food prices went higher, the bread price went high. It was often women who were starting those riots and who were the key actors in them. But then, of course, enfranchisement was all about giving men the vote. And so more and more in terms of formal political participation in a formal democracy, you have men getting these voices and women having a very different role and sort of almost having less of a role, right? So there's a kind of gender divide there in how women appear in democratic practices in Britain, and I think we can extend that to the US too, they become more formally excluded, right? Whereas before, everyone was sort of all, everyone was together participating in informal politics.
Yeah, so it sounds like we're talking about the public political space. You say not just in Britain, but with these trends that are going on, we see that here too.
Yeah. Yeah, where do we see politics being enacted publicly? It's a very rare thing. There will be like, you know, the mass protests of, you know, Black Lives Matter or something, or a one day rally, for some purpose, like women's rights or something like that. But it's not an everyday phenomenon. Even now in the US, where people are so desperate to see something done, you know, after the gun violence in Nashville a few days ago, and how, you know, this frustration is there that we can't get our voice heard. And the most I've seen people suggest is let's have a one-day walkout. And that's a great idea, but it's not, democracy is not a one-day thing, right? At least the way, if we're looking at crowd politics and the history of how that has worked in the past, it never worked in a day. It requires sustained everyday dialogue. It's an everyday conversation between the rulers and the ruled, where there's pressure being put, and the rulers being held accountable, whether they are monarchs or whether they are our congressional representatives or senators, right?
Yeah, and in the going back to the pre-colonial India, what they really had was they had this desire when they weren't happy to remove labor, and not remove it for a day, but I mean for a considerable period in which you could force a change. That's what the leaders wanted to avoid, but that's what the people had. But that's essentially gone in this situation that we're talking about now.
Well, it, in some places it isn't. I mean, we call this a general strike now, right?
Okay.
Moving your labor and leaving the village and going to live somewhere else, like the entire village leaving, the threat that, you know, worked in pre-colonial monarchies. We still have that in a form. The option is there for a general strike. Look at what's happening in France, in Paris, right? There, and it's not a one-day thing. And we don't know what that's going to add up to or if it will be effective or not. But, we saw this in India with the farmers' protest that lasted an entire year, where you have tens of thousands of farmers from all over India just camped out outside Delhi and insisting that they're not going to go back to their villages and do their work until their demands are met. And in that case, their demands were met. But in a sense, the fact that they did that for a year, and that way of living and what's being expressed in France right now, I mean, that is democracy. Right, regardless of the practical outcome of it, that is a way of living and politically, in a political life, in community, making demands consistently, constantly, in an everyday way on the rulers. That's what democracy really is.
You know, so let's go through some of the tenets that we like to think are come with democracy. One of them is picking your own leaders. But you've asked the question, does the power to elect your own leaders, does that actually guarantee democracy or the maximum freedom? Does it?
I mean, it's nice if you're talking about a monarchy as a situation where you can't elect your leaders because it's hereditary, right? Mm-hmm. But at least, in some monarchies, you have the power to hold whoever is in charge accountable. But in the U.S. and in a parliamentary system like the U.K., where you know, they have the hereditary monarch, but they also have an elected prime minister and other leaders. I mean, yes, we can elect our leaders, and we sort of believe that that means we have a political voice and we live in a democracy. But once you elect them, if you can't hold them accountable, if they just do what they want and not what you want as a people, is it really that great that we have the power to elect them in the first place, right? You want to have you can't just elect them one day and then for 4 years they can ignore what the people want and do whatever they want.
So let's say we have an election. Mm-hmm. And in the election, we put certain people in office. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily, once they get there, have to listen to us.
Exactly.
Because they're already in office.
Right. And so that's what we had, I talk about this in the essay too, that, President Obama was elected by a lot of people who hoped that he would end the war on terror. And he campaigned on that, and then he gets into office, and he does not end the war on terror. He discovers that he doesn't even have the power to, because there are all these other, you know, parts of the state that are like the CIA and so on that are actually invested in this and running in it in a way that, you know, he as even as president doesn't have the power to kind of disrupt that. And so what he does to kind of hide the fact that he's not following through on his campaign promise is that he enshrouds the droning and everything that's at the core of the war on terror in more and more secrecy, because to hide the failure to end it. So because he's, when people are saying, you know, the war on terror is still going on, he doesn't have an answer for that, right? And then Trump is elected on the same promise of ending that war. So people promise things, they're elected, they don't follow through. And then there's this frustration, and then there's disillusionment. And then we have this cycle of like less participation. And, you know, I mean, in the US right now, I think in the last few years, we've had like serious frustration and disillusionment with the way our democracy works, and the sense that, but we always thought ours was the best democracy. So what else could there even be? And we've sort of forgotten that what made democracy work and what even led to the creation of the democracy we have was a lot of crowd politics and collective action, and which takes organizing, which takes community, which takes, when it needs to be sustained, it's not a one-day thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, so what we have now in terms of what we call democracy is really, we have democracy for one day, which is election day. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes something else once the polls close and the votes are counted.
Yeah, then everybody's like burdened by their daily lives. You know, it's like a vicious cycle. We elect people who are supposed to alleviate the, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, corporate enslavement, or just the struggles, daily struggles that we face in this country, where families are, you know, have to work really hard just to survive. And you don't have a lot of bandwidth left to be really informed about and participate in politics, and communities have broken down. And so then none of that gets addressed by the one day voting. And it's sort of this vicious cycle that gets endlessly reproduced. But I think we have to acknowledge that there's going to be, in the kind of political action that's required to solve some of these issues like gun violence, it's going to require a certain amount of sacrifice and perhaps even deprivation. Like, what if instead of a one-day walkout, teachers, we have teachers' unions, there's an existing organization for this. What if they organized a month-long march to state capitals, and people, ordinary people, join, families join? You lose a month of school. You lose, you know, maybe your salary for a month. But, you know, it's not impossible to do, right? And you might actually get the outcome you want. But I think people struggle a lot with the idea of sacrificing the daily routine. But look at the farmers in India. I mean, what they had to do that for an entire year, and it worked. So it's like, what are you prepared to do, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems that the what's lacking in terms of our ideas about democracy isn't so much the institutions as the participation of the people who are supposed to organize and make change. It cannot be a temporary thing. It cannot be for 24 hours or for a week. You're talking about an extended period, along with the fact that you have to be prepared to feel some pain.
Yes, yes, I agree with, yeah, all that you just said. Yeah, I mean, it's collective work. Like, the pain is spread out. When it's spread out among an entire community, it's more manageable, and there's mutual support in that. And that's when the farmers camped out outside Delhi in tens of thousands. They set up communal kitchens. They took care of each other. There was healthcare. I mean, it's not like everyone was left to fend for themselves. I mean, and that's the collective democratic way of life right there for a year, right?
We're talking with Stanford historian Priya Sethia about what it takes to make a democracy be something beyond just voting. I'm John McKay, sitting in for Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think. When you look at all this that we've been talking about, you get the impression that maybe there are some circumstances in which a modern, say, constitutional monarchy that's has a situation in which the leader is not necessarily, or the leader is more likely to do what the people want, as opposed to democracy where the people really only show up and make their feelings known for a day. That gets back to what you were talking about originally in terms of pre-colonial India.
Yeah, I think we should not fetishize the... So we all have the right to vote here, but there are constant attacks on rights, on the right to vote, and there's constant gerrymandering to make votes meaningless, right, or ineffectual. So I think we need to not assess the degree of democracy in our own society or other societies based on just the simple yes or no question, does everyone have the vote? And instead look at what space is there in that society for people to hold their leaders accountable, whether they have the vote or not. If they're able to hold a leader accountable, by having a mass rally or just camping out in front of the palace or whatever it is, you know, and more effectively than we are in our democratic republic in the United States, then, you know, maybe there's something we can learn from that.
You know, the idea of a monarchy responsive to the people, it really doesn't get a whole lot of attention. now we think of them, we're like, yeah, right, that there's just no possible way that that has ever worked. But there were some places where it did work for a time.
Yes, and I think what happened was, so I think many traditional monarchies worked that way in many places in the world. And I didn't have space to talk about all of that in my essay, but I mean, this is not something that's just restricted to India or the subcontinent. But I think what happened was that when European imperialism starts to unfold in places like India, and the interaction of that colonial presence of the British with the existing monarchies really changed how those monarchies worked and actually made them, in many cases, despotic and broke that reciprocal relationship between ruler and ruled. And then we get sort of the cartoonish version of, you know, the evil, the despotic oriental, you know, oriental despotic monarchy. And that kind of helped made us forget, you know, what pre-colonial monarchies were actually like and how they actually worked and what sustained them. And this is not to say they were never problems, or they were never oppressive, or they were never like extremely extractive or cruel to their people, but that there was a dynamic of feedback, you know, between ruler and ruled that could help keep that monarch in check in the same way that we imagine the right to vote is supposed to keep our elected rulers in check, you know, today.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that the key thing to a ruler in any kind of regime is security. The way to hold on to your power is security. And you're not going to be able to hold on to that power if the people are so upset that there's no food, there's no water, no services, that they're going to either revolt or leave. And under pre-colonial India, there were some places that were like that, in which that reciprocal relationship worked.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one word that's really helpful here is legitimacy. Like the key to a monarch being able, or a president or whoever, or a ruler to be able to stay in power is if they have a legitimacy. And what that means is that the people that they rule see them as the rightful ruler because they're actually serving what the people want, right? And, when a monarch or a president or a prime minister takes some action that departs from what the people will, they start to look illegitimate. Like that's what's happening with Macron right now, right? Even though he's an elected leader, right? He's starting to lose his legitimacy, and then you have this like mass collective action pushing back on it. So the people withdrawing their consent or their assent in what the leader is doing. That really is the dynamic.
So what should we be looking for then? It's not enough to be able to pick your leader. It's not enough to be able to elect someone. What are the things that you would suggest that we want to look for if what we're really looking for is a true working democracy?
I mean, I think, being in a crowd, being on the street together, it sounds very simple. It sounds very atavistic, maybe like something from your image of what the French Revolution looked like or what, 18th century food riots looked like. But that is, it's if we look at the long durée of human history, that is how we have always held our states and rulers accountable, our governments accountable. And we should not sort of downplay the importance of doing that because we have now arrived in this time where we have instead this like disciplined process of voting and counting ballots. I mean, this is our main power. It's our main source of empowerment. It's sort of when you say, as an individual, I will not put up with this. This is a violation of my sovereignty as a person, my human rights, my sense of what's right and what's just. And then you come together with other people who feel the same way and help them also understand that they feel the same way. It's a mutually shaped thing. And you go and express that. And whether or not your collective expression of that forces a change from the government is a secondary thought. You still have to experience that collective feeling of expressing it, because that is the democratic feeling. That is the feeling of, defending what is right. That is a feeling of sort of maintaining your sovereignty.
Expansion of public space, that's important too.
Yeah, I think we've had a real shrinking of public space. We think of public space as basically the roads, a few squares in our downtown, things like that. But there used to be literally commonly held lands everywhere in the world, right? Even in England, right? And that sense of spaces that we have collective access to has, those spaces have shrunk. But we do still have the streets and the roads and those squares in our downtowns. And other kinds of, wasteland, quote unquote, in suburbs and, parking lots, whatever you want to think of. And those are areas that, you need to get out of your chair and reading and, we need to read to learn, but you need to ultimately go out with other people and have your signs and make your slogans and do what has always worked to make change. You can just think of the civil rights movement in this country. Like, that worked.
When you look at Great Britain, for example, King Charles seems to be making an effort to acknowledge these past harms. Yeah. Do you expect that kind of thing, the problems with the result of colonialism, that sort of thing, do you expect that kind of thing to continue?
That he will continue to make those kinds of statements and calls for a better education on the past. And yeah. I mean, let's see. I think what I thought was that sort of the most hopeful thing about Charles becoming king was that he has always been such a vocal advocate for taking measures against climate change. Mm-hmm. And there is this convention that's developed in the UK that the monarch is not supposed to be involved in politics or make political statements. But I think one great promise he offers is to depoliticize the question of climate. And if it's, if he continues, I don't know what he's going to do, but if he continues to talk about it, maybe that will force us to think of climate as something that's not political, that even the British king can talk about safely, because it's just common collective survival sense, right? Let's see if he can continue to make helpful statements about how we need to British people need to reckon with the past of racism, colonialism, and so on. I don't think he's said much since he's become king.
There's been no apology. I know that people have been looking for some form of apology from the royal family. That has not been the case, but you do see countries like Jamaica, for example, that are making it, that are moving in a direction that seems to say, well, yes, we've been part of this, but we kind of want to distance ourselves to some degree. And that's been since the death of the Queen.
Right. So before the Queen died, Barbados had already sort of taken the step of removing the British monarch as head of the Barbados state. And so this conversation was starting in other, especially Caribbean countries where the Queen was still the head of state. And so that conversation started in Jamaica. And, you know, there was this kind of horrible visit of Prince William to Jamaica, where a lot of this came out, you know, before the Queen died. And so that conversation, I think, was just further stoked by the death of the Queen. And there is a very powerful Republican movement there. And there is a calendar for sort of considering now the process of removing the British monarch as being the head of state of Jamaica. And there were Republican conversations about becoming a republic, even in, you know, Canada and Australia and other Commonwealth countries that also take the British monarch as their formal head of state. So yes, that is going on in many places in the world.
You know, that narrative that we through past generations about historical progress and being made by democracies, do you think that still has an influence on us today?
Yeah, I think I definitely do. I think it's sort of become a norm, unquestioned way of thinking. But I think the fact that we face this existential threat, you know, with climate crisis, is forcing people to sort of examine that assumption, just like I think World War II was another watershed moment where a lot of philosophers in that time, you know, in the 1950s, sort of said, wait a minute, is history actually about progress? We just had this Holocaust and the death of 50 million people worldwide in this war. Maybe this is not going to be, this is not a story of progress. But then, you know, the kind of Cold War context put a pause on some of that reflection. And I think now with climate crisis, there's again this sort of questioning of the assumption that's been in place since the Enlightenment, and more of a sense that, you know, maybe history is this like continual flux that, you know, we live through and that is supposed to be more about, you know, us evolving as people in the course of our lifetimes on this earth, right? Rather than any assumption about, you know, where the earth is going to end, because clearly all the things that we thought were going to cause progress have just landed us in this major existential crisis. So what then is history about? How do we kind of find meaning in history? And I think one way to do that is to think the way someone like, you know, Herbert Butterfield or Mahatma Gandhi or E.P. Thompson and some of those post-World War II or, you know, thinkers of that era, you know, sort of what they concluded was that actually, you know, we live through history and the meaning we make from it is, you know, how we, it's about us, right? It's like who we become through history, not what the world becomes through history.
Historian Priya Sethia teaches at Stanford. Her essay in Foreign Policy magazine is "Democracy Isn't Just About Voting. Pre-colonial kingdoms challenge our beliefs about people, power, and monarchies." A lot to think about. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast or go to our website, think.kera.org. I'm John McKay, sitting in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.